Major support for Out to Lunch is provided by the law firm of Jones Walker, established in 1937 with over 375 attorneys in offices throughout the U.S., providing a comprehensive range of services to a local, national, and international client base. JonesWalker.com. And by Shorten Associates, legal recruiters in Louisiana and Texas.
Welcome to this special edition of Out to Lunch Louisiana. I'm Christian Mader in Lafayette.
I'm Peter Ricciuti in New Orleans.
And in Baton Rouge, I'm Stephanie Regal.
Normally, we're the hosts of Out to Lunch in our respective cities. But during the course of the current public health crisis, we're joining forces to bring you a statewide look at what's happening in the world of business and finance.
Now, currently, we're all quarantined in our respective homes. Normally, I'd be having lunch at Commander's Palace. Commander's is closed this week, but you can find out more about their plans to resume pickup and delivery at commanderspalace.com.
In Baton Rouge, the restaurant that normally hosts Out to Lunch, Mansur's on the Boulevard, is open for pickup and delivery. You can order by calling them at 225-923-3366.
In Lafayette, the French Press is doing curbside takeout. You can also get menu items, including a family dinner, delivered through Waiter or Grubhub, or directly from the restaurant, 337-233-9449. Remember the days when you could go out to a restaurant or a bar or a music festival? In Louisiana, we have over 400 festivals every year. From the internationally renowned like Jazz Fest in New Orleans and Festival International here in Lafayette, to unique local favorites like the Shrimp and Petroleum Festival in Morgan City or the Rice Festival in Crowley, where my dad's from. And then there's the literal thousands of bars and restaurants across the state with regional specialties like smoked meat in Ville Platte or the Muffaletta in New Orleans. For now, though, our Louisiana way of life has come to a grinding halt. It's tough times for all of us, but especially for folks and businesses that rely on social gathering, not just because they're closed down, but also because of the uncertainty of what their businesses will look like when we get back to normal. Gus Resende owns 7 food and drink establishments in Acadiana, and through his company Social Entertainment, he's the promoter of a handful of festivals and events, among them the Acadiana Po'boy Festival. Gus, we're told the CARES Act has provisions in it that are designed to help small business owners like you and your employees, even the ones who might, work primarily for tips. Are you finding that to be true? Is there federal help that's actually helping you?
I believe so. It's still there's still a lot of things that need to be tightened up by the government when it comes to the application process. We are working hand-in-hand with our bankers, since the government is asking the bankers to obviously facilitate the process. But it's still kind of, we're still, you know, the word that we're getting from our CPAs and our attorneys and the bankers is to be patient as they develop the proper application process. But we believe that help is on the way and is going to give us a little bit of a breathing room right now. But It's still a little murky, the application process and how funds are going to be dispersed and how we're going to be able to apply for the funds and what will be forgiven, what will be a loan. Still a little bit of, we're not quite certain yet how all is going to play out. We're taking this day by day. We're looking at each business and what their needs are. We're waiting to see what the government's really going to be doing and when it comes to helping. But this is really time for us to kind of take a step back, reflect, and look at each business in a different way, because there's no such a thing as looking at the whole thing at once. You're going to have to look at each one, and each one is going to have their own destiny for now. So,
and Gus, you said that the bankers are advising patience, you know, as people work through the process. Obviously, you're lucky because you have a couple of different types of establishments, right? So you can evaluate. But for those that just have one or two, how long do these guys have? How long can they be patient? And what are you hearing from the others in your community? Because it's already week 4, right? How much more can they weather?
Yeah, it's, you know, this pandemic has been so eye-opening for a state like ours. You know, we have our own set of issues, as we know. And we are so interrelated with the hospitality, you know, and what that means, you know, events and community. And we're so close to each other in so many ways, how we eat, how we dance, how we play, how we communicate. So, but also this pandemic is showing some of the flaws that the hospitality industry as a whole has. I mean, we've been talking about wages for so long. We've been talking about compensation to cooks versus compensation to bartenders. We've been talking about just how the entire business structure exists for the restaurants and bars. And we are noticing that not only employees live paycheck to paycheck, but business owners live paycheck to paycheck, which is a very flawed way of running a business because it doesn't give you any security and sustainability. So we're going to have to take a real hard look when all this is over. And this may not answer your question right now, but we're going to have to take a very hard look at how the hospitality industry is going to continue to operate in the future, because it's obviously not sustainable. It takes 2 weeks to break most of us. So that's just not a viable solution. But speaking now in the urgent matter of people needing help, you're right, Stephanie, there's going to be people that already, you know, they were going into that very first week of the pandemic already probably negative on their books as they go into the week. So you can only imagine that what kind of pressure that's putting. One of the things that we do is events. We were tasked by our company partners to put on 22 events this year. And we haven't done a single one because we were just getting started in the month of March. So now one of the things that we're really doing is participating in webinars all over the country and trying to understand what other production event companies are doing. And the word on the street is collaboration, collaboration, collaboration. We're going to be living different days after this thing is all done. I think we're going to have to hopefully trim the fat a little bit and refocus how we handle hospitality, especially in our state.
You made note of the fact that, right, that there are some cracks or some flaws in the hospitality industry specifically that you think this might force us to resolve. What about at events? I mean, is there something in the way that we conduct events that might change for the better after this?
Yeah, I think it's going to, you know, competition is going to get tighter. You know, us being a production company that we are a for-profit company that puts on several events throughout the year, but we do have events that benefit certain nonprofits. The approach that we are taking is we need to be very sensitive and careful how we approach our programming schedule moving forward, because we have nonprofit organizations that their livelihood is to put on that one event every year. And if we come in and we rock the boat, it's going to hurt our reputation, it's going to hurt our ability to put on events. So the reality is that, I don't know if I'm quite answering the question, Christian, but I think the way we are looking at it is that it's going to provide new opportunities, but we need to be very sensitive of who has been here before, who has done certain events before. And I think there is some sort of seniority that we have to pay respect to it in order to keep the industry viable. But I'm sure there will be some new events out there. But I encourage everybody to rethink about, if you have a new event, rethink about hosting it this year. There's going to be a limitation in sponsorship. There's going to be a limitation in resources from our city officials to be able to put on events. So we are doing that ourselves and trying to be responsible, but still trying to keep a company moving. You know, right now we're just taking one day at a time, but I think it will be a transformational thing happening on the hospitality industry across the board.
Gus Resende is a restaurateur, festival promoter, and co-owner of Social Entertainment in Lafayette. Gus, thanks so much for joining us on Out to Lunch Louisiana.
Thank you, guys.
You're listening to a special edition of Out to Lunch Louisiana with Christian Mader in Lafayette, Stephanie Regal in Baton Rouge, and I'm Peter Ricciuti here in New Orleans. New Orleans might not have invented the concept of partying, but we have certainly perfected it. Before it became an alleged virus incubator, Mardi Gras in New Orleans was one of the most celebrated parties on earth. There are free parties every single night on Bourbon Street and Frenchman Street. Even in the world of business, we're known for socializing. Although conventions are meant to be places for doing business, there's a reason Las Vegas and New Orleans are two of the country's biggest convention destinations. In New Orleans, the world of tourism and conventions meet in the offices of an organization called New Orleans and Company, a city body that was formed by the recent combination of the New Orleans Tourism Marketing Corporation and the Convention and Visitors Bureau. The Senior Vice President and Chief Marketing Officer of New Orleans & Company is Mark Romig. Mark, you've been a guest on Out to Lunch before under happier circumstances. Back then, I would never have imagined that I was going to be asking you about turning the New Orleans Convention Center into a hospital, but that is what has happened. In a city that's already stretched pretty thin for medical care, where is New Orleans finding enough medical staff to run an extra 1,000-bed hospital?
The governor stood up the Morial Convention Center to provide the step-down facility for patients who were no longer critical, and they would free up beds in the hospitals for these individuals to come to the convention center to then be monitored and discharged. And the governor, through his GOSEP office, has contracted out to bring in the medical professionals to do the necessary work at the convention center. And they've stood up, again, another set of units across the street in a parking lot for people who are in the symptoms and waiting for their results as well. So it's necessary. I think the convention center is playing a very vital role, as it has played for many, many years in our community. And obviously we see this being limited and in use, and at some point we'll get to the other side of this, and then it'll be mitigated and brought back to its use as a convention facility. So it's an important role. Our customers have applauded the use of the facility because they know how important it is. And it's just not happening in New Orleans. As you know, the Javits Center in New York City is currently being used in this way. And many other facilities like our convention center around the country are being used as that surge facility.
And Mark, you know, we've all been to a convention, but you've been on the other side of things. I cannot imagine how difficult it is to unwind in a convention, to postpone it and cancel everything. Do you play a role in all that?
Obviously, there are cancellations, and turning those cancellations into postponements, retaining the business for later in the year. And we've been successful in some regards to do that. Obviously, we're projecting that we will be out of this, and at some point in late summer and then into the fall, we can slot these conventions into spaces that were open. We still had a very robust year ahead of us, and so we're using opportunities that we see in this calendar year to get this business to come in, because that stands up the jobs that have been affected, as well as the restaurants and all the other aspects of the tourism industry. So it's a mammoth effort. It's very time-consuming. These conversations are very critical and delicate. And again, it's just not like Katrina happening to us and we've got the rest of the world coming to our aid. Everyone's going through the same process, and we're in a whole new dynamic here on how to figure this out. And the conversation earlier about festivals, sporting events, all of this is being rethought of as how do we approach this as humankind, and how our behaviors are going to be changing. And that will directly affect, I think, hospitality going forward.
So, Mark, that sort of leads to the question that I was going to ask you, basically what Peter had asked of Gus. I mean, even when the restaurants reopen, or even if people feel comfortable driving down for the weekend and staying in a hotel, walking around the French Quarter, what are you hearing on the webinars with your fellow convention and visitors bureaus around the country? I mean, do they think that it's going to be a long, long time before people really do feel comfortable gathering in the tens of thousands in indoor facilities?
Yeah, in New Orleans alone, we have 145 plus festivals. And to Gus's point, I think there'll be a lot of rethinking of what that looks like going forward. Restaurants, as it relates to seating protocols, you know, when you think through the distancing measures that we're being asked to follow now, 6 feet apart, how does that look in a restaurant when we do get to stand up our activities? What does that look like as it relates to checking into a hotel? And are people going to be required to have a mask, and what does that look like? So I think, again, a lot of discussions, the industry's trying to figure this out as well, but, you know, we're having to follow the experts. We have to follow the medical experts on what they're suggesting, or not suggesting in this case, recommending and requiring for us to do so that we can get on the other side of this pandemic. And of course, we're all thinking through the day that we get the vaccine done, and then we can look back on this and say, oh yeah, remember those days. I mean, some of us, well, not too many of us on the call right now, go back to the 60s when we would stand in line for our TB shots. But it was just sort of that same feeling. We needed to get something that gave everybody the confidence that we could react and be part of our life again. But I do think we're seeing a different life ahead of us for all of us. We're staying positive. We've got to stay positive. We want to bring these jobs back, and we want to make sure that our economy can stand up across the world. We just got to listen to the medical professionals.
I'm curious what it's going to look like to try and, you know, market that New Orleans is safe and open for business again, kind of once we get, let's say, the public policy okay that says, all right, things are pretty safe. I mean, there could be some lasting damage or at least lingering damage from what we've seen in the national media about, you know, well, this was all caused by Mardi Gras, or even like in my profession in journalism, right? There were reporters that had gone to that journalism conference in New Orleans that sort of contracted the virus, right? And some of these things might have lingering effects. I mean, how do you see actually trying to rebrand that it's safe?
Yeah, that's a very good point, Christian. I think it's going to take some truth messaging, and the fact that we are ahead of it. You know, we're one of the four testing sites in the nation that got the test done, which I think was one of the reasons why you saw so many results coming back. We know this, the truth of the story of Mardi Gras. There were no federal guidelines given to the city about Mardi Gras not being anything other than what it was going to be, a normal festival. This mayor has spoken about how she would have done different things if she had been given direction. So there were major events happening in other cities at the same time around the country. But I got to tell you, we've got a great marketing team that knows how to message and knows how to speak the truth. And I think we take the right steps, and we can overcome this as we overcame the BP oil spill when people thought there was oil on Bourbon Street. We had to message that out as well. And of course, 10 years after Katrina, people thought there was still water on the streets of New Orleans. And again, it's just a matter of attacking that in a very truthful way. And we'll do that. We'll do that with the rest of the nation and ensure that people know that when they come to the city of New Orleans, they will enjoy the city that they have enjoyed for over 300 years.
Mark, you know, I've been asked to do a couple of webinars down the road for virtual conventions and everything. But one of the things that we know is that the real advantage of a convention is the networking. So can you replace a convention?
No, that's interesting. There's all of us have attended meetings virtually, and it's just not the same, right? You want to be able to see somebody eye to eye, you know, in the days, shake your hand, make that deal, go out to dinner, enjoy a speaker or a conference trade show, and be part of the activity. Again, I think we need to follow our federal and medical guidelines. I don't think anyone's giving up on meetings and conventions, but I think we're going to be thinking it differently. And we're creative people in this nation, and I think we'll figure that out as well, because people do need to have some sense of camaraderie and personal touch, but as long as it's in a very safe way. So my sense is that we'll think this through, and all of us, the entire nation, entire the world, will come together and make this better. We'll be stronger for it, that's for sure.
Mark Romig is Senior Vice President and Chief Marketing Officer of New Orleans & Company. Mark, thank you so much for joining us today on Out to Lunch Louisiana.
Thanks for having me, and best wishes to everybody. Stay safe.
You're listening to a special edition of Out to Lunch Louisiana with Peter Ricchiuti in New Orleans, Christian Mader in Lafayette, and I'm Stephanie Regal in Baton Rouge. I'd like to introduce you to Steve Suleiman. Steve is originally from Belgium, where he got a degree in international business and management. After that, he got a Doctor of Science degree from Tulane University School of Public Health and Tropical Medicine. Steve, I imagine when you pursued these two very disparate avenues of academic study, business and tropical medicine, there were people who wondered when you would ever be able to use those two skill sets at the same time. And, well, that time has arrived. As Executive Director of the Baton Rouge Health District, you are uniquely qualified to understand how this pandemic is undermining our economy. So, let me start by asking you, in your uniquely expert opinion, does the Louisiana medical community have the financial resources and physical infrastructure to keep up with this pandemic?
Right now, the medical community, both across the state as well as across the world, is struggling, keeping up with the demands of the COVID pandemic and the care that it requires. So I think given the circumstances, the medical community across the state is doing as well as it can. And I do believe it's still providing high quality care. I've been a little bit involved in surge and capacity planning for the Baton Rouge market. The hospitals have doubled their number of available ICU beds and vented beds to meet the needs of the patients across Region 2. And to date, those beds have not been filled yet. So we're definitely more than meeting demand, at least for the time being.
We've seen, like in New Orleans, for instance, where we were discussing a few minutes ago, converting the convention center into a makeshift facility. Has there been any planning for that in Region 2? Has there been talk of using the convention center, the Raising Cane's River Center in Baton Rouge for something like that?
Yes. So in the search planning that is going on, there's both an immediate surge goal. And that was at least increasing the number of ICU beds by 50%, and that has been accomplished and more than completed. That goal has been met, and then there's an extended surge goal in case there is a significant escalation in number of cases, and that will include a similar scenarios in New Orleans, expanding the hospital capacity to the convention center, and then the most complex care is provided, de-escalating to an environment like the convention center, setting up a hospital there.
As over the years, we've seen a shift towards telemedicine. Obviously, that's been greatly accelerated in the past few weeks. We've also seen a shift to more outpatient care. Is this pandemic exposing weaknesses in that system? Do we need to go back to a world where we have more acute care beds and ICU beds for sick people? Because, I mean, when you look at the numbers, as many people as have this pandemic, it's still a very, very small percentage of the overall population and an even smaller percentage that's critically ill from it. And yet we're hearing that we're reaching the limits of being able to care for those people. So where's the disconnect?
Louisiana is arguably better prepared to deal with emergency scenarios than a lot of other places, in part because there's been a significant amount of emergency planning done in the past by MOSEP at the city level, GOSEP at the state level, institutions like the Louisiana Center for Emergency Preparedness, because of some of the natural disasters, some of the other scenarios that the state has to consider. And the nature of the pandemic is significantly different and is quite unique, but yet the foundation of productively bringing different stakeholders together and having meaningful conversations and quick decision-making into how address difficult circumstances, I think is something Louisiana, including Baton Rouge, is uniquely well prepared to do.
There's a reason to some extent that the FDA has been plotting and how it, you know, regulates or approves different drugs or different treatments. I mean, do you see a scenario where some of these moves that we're making to deal with an immediate problem bite us long-term?
Yes and no. I mean, a lot of the pathways towards approval have been accelerated, but a lot of the key stakeholders and the mechanisms are still the same. A lot of the testing that goes on for COVID, as well as any other tests, is typically done within the CLIA regulatory framework, and most every hospital has a CLIA accredited certified lab that does most all of their in-house testing. So even though there's an accelerated new group of COVID tests available, the framework within those tests are completed are under the same regulatory, the same sort of quality scrutiny.
I hate to say there's been a positive side to this, but all I was thinking of is that what you do in economic development with biotech and all of that is pretty esoteric to the majority of the people. And all of a sudden, people have realized that you're the answer to life itself. I mean, is that going to change the way you approach companies and get funding and things like that?
Well, I think one of the most interesting things to me has been that Louisiana has had, for the longest time, world-class organizations that within the field that they're most active have been world-renowned or very well-known. To give you an example, people from all over the country travel to Pennington Biomedical Research Center in Baton Rouge to hear the latest and greatest about cardiometabolic research, about obesity, which in this case, interestingly, More and more of the evidence is suggesting that there is a significant link not only between age and susceptibility to COVID, but also between body mass and weight and COVID. But some of those places like Pennington within their field are world leaders, and that's what brought people like me to Louisiana to come and live and work and learn. And I think for that expertise to be a little more visible and recognized, I think is a very interesting, is still a very challenging and affects tons of people on a very personal level. So it's a very regrettable set of circumstances, but at the same time, it's been a really interesting environment to see how some of the world-class science and expertise and how it can really translate into direct help and resources for people at the time when they need it most.
And Steve, before we let you go, I'm just going to pivot a little bit, but given your public health background, you know, when we talk about wanting to go back to normal or being on the other side of this, we all know that's not really going to happen in en masse until there is a vaccine. Realistically, best case scenario, how long until you could vaccinate, you know, huge swaths of the population? Best case, is it really 2021? Is it late 2021? Is it 2022 or beyond?
Well, I think some of the information that Dr. Fauci has shared as the leader of NIAID and NIH, I think at least a year or more realistically, even on an accelerated track, because it's not only developing a good vaccine candidate, it's testing it and making sure that it's safe, and then building the infrastructure to manufacture it. And I know a lot of that planning is going on now. A lot of the work is going on, has been accelerated. A lot of resources are being redirected and being made available. I've seen some of the announcements of NIH recently, the Gates Foundation. So I think everyone's trying the absolute best they can. But in terms of, you know, drug discovery, drug development, vaccine development, months and in some cases even a year longer is light speed, is very, very quickly.
Well, Steve, thank you so much. Steve Suleiman is executive director of the Baton Rouge Health District. We appreciate you joining us here today on Out to Lunch. Be safe out there.
And thank you for joining us on this special edition of Out to Lunch Louisiana. We edited these conversations to fit in the time slot here on your NPR radio station. And you can hear longer versions of these conversations wherever you normally get your Out to Lunch podcast. If you're not an Out to Lunch podcast subscriber, search for Out to Lunch, Out to Lunch Baton Rouge, or Out to Lunch Acadiana on your podcast app. The producer of our show is Grant Morris. Our technical director is Eric Merrill. Photos from the show on our website and social media are taken by Jill LaFleur. I'm Christian Bader in Lafayette.
I'm Peter Ricciuti in New Orleans.
And I'm Stephanie Regal in Baton Rouge. We'll see you back here next week for more Out to Lunch Louisiana. Until then, if you're an essential industry and still going to work, thank you. And remember to take care of yourself. If you're not going to work, please stay home and stay safe.
Mitchell Foreman wrote and performs all the music on Out to Lunch. You can hear Mitchell's music anywhere great jazz is sold or streamed, and at MitchellForeman.com. Major support for Out to Lunch is provided by the law firm of Jones Walker, established in 1937 with over 375 attorneys in offices throughout the U.S., providing a comprehensive range of services to a local, national, and international client base. JonesWalker.com. And by Shorten Associates, legal recruiters in Louisiana and Texas.
We all make mistakes in life. Si tu avais manqué la dernière Franco Mix, c'est OK. To be made coûté this Thursday at 9 p.m. seulement sur KRVS 88.7 avec Drake Benoit LeBlanc. Et c'est formidable.
You already know how it's going to turn out. The writing is on the wall. The fix is in. Insert your own cliche here. But for some reason, you roll up your sleeves and get started. The next Snap Judgment. Dirty work. Dirty work. Snap Judgment. Storytelling with a beat. Do not miss it.
Coming up tonight at 10 on KRVS.
Vous êtes à l'écoute de KRVS 88.7 FM Lafayette-Lac-Charles. This is public radio for Acadiana. KRVS 88.7 FM Lafayette-Lac-Charles.